is a, and I think the British learned that a long time ago. I think the British are very good at that, and the Europeans seem to be better at the fact of saying, in all of your various intelligence, we go towards a computer and numerically doing things. Mm-hmm. They, on the other hand, have returned, have went that way and returned to more or less the written mm-hmm. methods. And the objectivity is in other words, it's better to catch one real terrorist than to tell somebody that you've interrogated 10.
So what happens then when people make policy using these programs?
The policies turn out to be, in almost all instances, just filled with inconsistencies. And it's example is weapons of mass destruction. You could, through numerical methods, create assumptions and begin with those assumptions and then look at it in a way of saying, I saw, you know, a piece of machinery over here that looked like, that I assumed was this. I look over here, assume that it's this, and through your methodology come up with the fact that it is. But if you're sitting there and you look at it from the sense of just a logical deduction, here I am, the country of Iraq. Have I ever had a nuclear program of any distinction whatsoever? How many people do I have in it? And go through that process, then you're going to end up with, and then the other thing is, which we have, which we're very, very predisposed to, is the fact of counting various positioning of equipments, because it's the easiest way to do it. In other words, if I fly over, I see something, I say that's it, then I say there are 12 of them. But what people don't understand is if I'm shooting 12, what are those, RPGs, that's different. All I have to do is shoot one Honest John, which is the lowest thing, that was the lowest thing on our list of technologies. It would destroy 80 or 90 RPGs. So, I mean, you've got to look at the technological aspects, and you've got to go into each one of these and create what is really occurring. You can create your own illusions by numbers.
So, can you just, like, explain a little how this worked in Vietnam and the Phoenix program?
Well, in the Phoenix program in Vietnam, it worked in the fact of, let's say, body counts and the number of individuals that were supposedly in the communist infrastructure. First of all, diagrams were made of what a communist infrastructure was, mm-hmm. probably brought in by some individuals who were interrogated and created this more or less organization. But as you know, in reality, all organizations, the organization that you find in Louisiana, mm-hmm. and you said it was, let's say, the Revenue Department, is different than the Revenue Department in California. So there is no comparisons. Mm-hmm. You take each thing as it is, and then find out more and more about it. But don't try to create a dynamic whereby you're equating, and what we do a lot of times is equate many things with ourselves. And that's a cultural thing. We always try to act like, well, if there's only three Viet Cong, that's like there's three Americans. No, three Viet Cong who are out there can make a lot more problem if they know their area and are capable of literally believing so strongly in their cause that they will take any risk to defer that person from kind of getting into that area. Mm-hmm. And America wouldn't do that, because America has no reason to do that, because that isn't his territory. So when we're fighting overseas, we're fighting in the other man's land. We've got to look at it from his point of view, and we don't ever do that. We have a, and that's a culture, again, it comes back to our culture. We have a concept that everybody else is wrong and we're right. Start with the concept that they're neither right nor wrong, nor are we, but that we're fighting. And then go from that point. You don't need to have, that's another thing that the British always said, you do not need to hate your enemy. Respect your enemy. If you begin to respect your enemy, then you'll know what that enemy has, because that enemy will then more or less show what he has. In the fact of, let's say, weapons of mass destruction, Saddam Hussein, we forgot, had an enemy much greater than ourselves on the other side of his border, Iran. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, his whole reasoning behind keeping weapons of mass destruction was to defer Iran. And, to be honest with you, Turkey to some degree. Those two nations were the ones that he was trying to say, hey, you screw with me and I'm going to get you really good with weapons of mass destruction. Mm. Then we come along and say, oh, well, Christ, he has weapons of mass destruction because he says, but he didn't do it because he said, you can't say, well, he said that and therefore it's right. It just means that this guy's bluffing, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, so don't take his word. Yeah. Don't take the word of a person. Find out the action. And then if you sit there and you said, well, Colonel Fulcher, were you over in Iran like 10 years ago? Yeah. Well, what did you think about their army? Well, they were out there running around this football or soccer field, and they were driving their trucks around. And every so often, a truck would stop, and a guy would get out, and another guy would get in and try and drive. Well, what was the reason for that? Well, a lot of the kids from the villages around and everything don't know how to drive, so they were teaching them how to drive. Well, God, you mean they don't even know how to drive? No, probably maybe 50% of them don't know how to drive. Well, 50% don't know how to drive. Well, what type of army could you have where 50% of your army didn't know how to drive? Mm. And then you say, well, how about their ability to shoot different weapons? Well, as long as they had a rifle, they were okay. But once they got into mortars or something, they just didn't know how to do it too well. Well, after a bit, you kind of look at the guy and say, well, Jesus, this is not a group of people that you have to worry about too damn much. You know, it was like with us, with the Russians. When the Finnish intelligence services came across to the British and said to the British, you know, it's really crazy. We went on a exercise with the Russians. We were observers to Russian exercise. And all of their vehicles had a tube radios. Mm-hmm. And he said, they had tube radios, and this is in 1975, where all of ours had already left the tube. Mm-hmm. The tube was left in the 38. Then what you've got is command and control must be absolutely worthless in the Russian army. Well, you got the biggest army in the world, you don't have command and control, it's worthless to you. Again, you have to look at these various things, you know, and analyze it from those points of view. Those are simple things. But then what you have to do is get into it and say, what is this Iranian thinking right now? Does this Iranian really want to go to war with the United States? Now, that's a whole different game, because you're saying, if that Iranian wants to go to war with the United States, would Kazakhstan and those groups that are above him, if he got pounded, Tehran got pounded tomorrow, who would be in the next day? It would be Americans. It would be from the north. Mm. So this guy's not really wild about getting his ass blown away on the thing. So, you know, all of these things have to be brought into situation. But again, our complete, utter belief in numbers is the worst thing that can happen in the intelligence.
was wondering if you could share any anecdotes from your time in Vietnam that just give a sense of the corruption and infiltration.
Corruption was unbelievable. Not unlike the corruption that's occurring right now in Iraq. By the very nature of a capitalist country running a war, you're going to find corruption. And you will always find people who are willing to be corrupted. So therefore, I mean, in Vietnam, the Koreans would come over, they would go into our areas, they would take the jeeps that we gave them, line them up, and take them into the harbor of Quy Nhon, put the jeeps on boats, and send them back to Korea. And most of the jeeps that we gave to any of the Korean contingents, that's the reason they must have got five times as many jeeps as there ever were. Yeah. With the Vietnamese would go and not pay their soldiers at all. They would tax inordinately. It's like anything else in life. What the Vietnamese saw from us, because we brought over a bunch of people from the United States who were kind of, I would say, like career Vietnamese experts. Mm-hmm. And those guys that screw the damn little Vietnamese girls, have these big parties. In Vietnam, like any third world nation, once you see things, the rumor occurs. And rumor is much faster than the regular communications. Mm-hmm. So if you have a housemaid and you're screwing her, everybody knows about it. I mean, all the way along from one place to another. If you're a drunk and you get drunk every night, you know, they know about it. If you're out stealing things from like radios and reselling them or stuff like various military gear or even household stuff and everything like that, because USA had all type of things. Mm-hmm. They had, boats. If you're doing that, people knew about it. So yes, there just absolute corruption. But then Sealin, which was owned by LBJ's wife for part ownership, I mean, it went right straight to the White House, and not unlike Halliburton. So, I mean, you know, the fact remains that, and when the young officers and the young intelligence officers see that type of stuff, there are some of them who have an ethical mode, depending on what type of education, what type of family they come from. Then there are others who take total advantage of it and say, God, let me get in on the deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I had all Louisianans down in some place, and you were corrupt, mm-hmm. within a matter of probably 2 months, you'd have eight times as much corruption, because when you're in Louisiana and you say, this is bad, this is not good, we shouldn't be doing this, the other guy looks at you and says, hey, how do we get in on the deal?
Yeah.
That's just part of the Louisiana culture. Well, that culture, you know, is everywhere in the world. So you have a ready-made aspect of corruption. By the very nature of war, black market corruption occurs. The only way you can stop that corruption is literally by arresting high-ranking officers and civilians who are in the country and literally executing them.
Because they have knowledge of it and are condoning it.
Because they're doing it.
Yeah.
Because a guy has knowledge, I wouldn't kill him. But if a guy is doing it, that's the only way you're going to stop it, because otherwise they'll keep doing it.
Yeah.
They're not going to, if you send a guy off to Leavenworth or something, hell, there's a lot of guys over in Iraq would love to go to Leavenworth.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not like, yeah, it's a damn good improvement so much. What I'm saying is, corruption, and then as a war winds down, which this war will wind down at one point in time, it's even more, the corruption is at as much at in the end, more in the end than any other time.
Is that because people are trying to get, squeeze every buck out of the Americans?
Well, mostly the Americans, what we have to understand is war is a business. Mm-hmm. And the Americans are in the business of war. American companies are in the business of war. Therefore, as war goes down, American businesses see their bottom line go down. So therefore, they try to get as much as possible out of the war as they can. Mm-hmm. And then they start another one. Mm-hmm. It's a cycle.
So government contracts have been a big issue in the war on terror. And I know that you saw companies like Bechtel operating in Vietnam.
Right.
So I was just wondering if you could make elaborate a bit here about, like...
Halliburton is the same as Bechtel. These, again, but what we do is we look at it from the sense of the in-country corruption. What we should be looking at it is from the sense of the U.S. in-country corruption. In other words, these companies are corrupt by the very nature that the politicians or the political class gives them the capability to be corrupt. So it's not, it's like anything else. It's a lot like what we saw in Vietnam and we've seen here in this last war. We're constantly going after the wrong humans that are doing things. A kid who is down at the squad level who kills a person, that isn't the person you have to get mad at. You have to get mad at the commanding general or the colonel who creates the atmosphere and sits around at night at the officer's mess or something and says all of these wogs should be killed. Or our news media and our just our total society. Where, I mean, I have just been amazed lately, especially, again, the religious right in this country literally believes that the only good Muslim is a dead Muslim. Now, that's very sad. There's something wrong with our educational system. Who do I blame for that? I blame, literally, the professors in our higher educational institutions who have not been able to convey to the people who run these organizations and to the young men who are going to be running these things, that judgmental aspects like that will get you nothing but disaster. So, I mean, and I don't see a great outcry. It amazes me. I mean, you know, in Vietnam, there was a greater outcry of young students and everything. And again, the reason was because there wasn't as large a population in the United States that was worried about what occurred in Vietnam as there is a population in the United States that worry about what happens in the Middle East. So therefore, again, it's the unspoken situation of Zionism. And we don't talk about it enough. And we don't come to grips with it. And we don't tell each other. And to be truthful, for whatever note, I don't know what it is, but I think even my Jewish colleagues do not want to bring it up because they have to, by nature, believe in it. So therefore, what you end up with is you're ending up with an illusion, sort of like, and not coming to grips with what really is occurring. I think Bush has used this to his advantage. I think a lot of people have used this to their advantage because there's not an open communications in this instance. You know, and let's be truthful, a person who brings this up, he can be pretty strong and he can be pretty rich and he can get killed, mm-hmm. which in itself is not good because we have to at one time do this. We have to, and I'm saying this not as anti-Zionist. I'm saying this as pro-Zionist in the fact that I believe that we should start looking at what we're doing and what the long-term ramifications of it is. I don't think it's to any advantage to Israel to continue to war with its neighbors.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's to any advantage to Israel for the neighbors to perceive that the United States is a big bully, that when it gets its back to the wall, it comes in and beats the crap out of everybody. And, you know, because I'll be truthful, the Chinese and the Indians are looking at this.
Yeah.
And they're thinking to themselves, hey, what are we going to have to do? You know?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a, it's really kind of a long-term, and there again, we're doing the same things. I don't see us doing very many things differently than we did in Vietnam. And that's very frightening to me, because we should have learned many lessons in Vietnam. And yet I don't think we've learned one. Mm-hmm. And especially how to handle civilian populations. You know, and Karzai in Afghanistan, it's very unfortunate, but you don't put one tribe in charge of another tribe and think that it's going to all turn out real good.
Yeah.
Because these are historical aspects. We should look at it from the historical point and look at who should be on a member of a council. Stop trying to create democracy where you have 250 people. Maybe only have 10 people, but they would be in charge of each one of the groups that would be involved in this. See how many you bring in. The ones you can't bring in, then war on those. But try to bring together as much mutuality as possible in those things. You know, and again, we've got to watch. We're sitting around doing this in the Middle East situation. We're not watching the Chinese, the Indians, or the Europeans, who, in the long term, are probably going to be our competitors. I mean, I've never heard anyone. I don't know anyone in business today that says that the Middle East is going to compete in the world market. But I do know a lot of people who say Europe is and Asia is going to. So, you know, and that's what we're all about, to be very frank. So if you're going to go into competition, find out who the hell you're going to compete with. Not drain yourself on something other than that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess related to corruption, what about infiltration?
You'll always find infiltration into any group. The question is not so much the infiltration as much as what can an infiltrator do? I mean, what is his ability? I think that comes down to everything. It's like information. Many people have information, but can you act upon it? The important thing is the action, not the fact of a person either being knowledgeable of something or a person even being among your ranks who is dissatisfied with it. It's the fact of how much can he act on it, and can he act on a crucial moment that would change the dynamics. In the last part of Vietnam, there was no need, because people on the ground level knew exactly what was occurring. And there was no surprises about that this was petering out, and that the United States was moving out of country and everything. So infiltration was only, I had a district chief who, you know, readily admitted to the fact of being, you know, in the National Liberation Front. I had a MFS officer who admitted to that. In the end, they kind of did that out of survival for themselves. I mean, you know, they didn't want to be on the loser side too much. So that just occurs, especially in your civil war. There's a civil war occurring, you're going to find that occurring, where you have swaying back and forth.
And then I was wondering, kind of like related to infiltration, but at a different level, can you talk about if there are any accommodations between VCI and GVN officials, like
yes.
Subtle tacit arrangements
right. That
undermined Phoenix, I guess?
Well, yes, undermined Phoenix and undermined the whole, I mean, from the beginning, as I said earlier, the Vietnamese were not only warring upon each other because of ideological concepts, but they were warring on the other groups like the Montagnards, the Campos, and stuff like that. So there was a mutuality of interest between both the, not so much the VCI, because VCI was an irregular force, mm-hmm. but between the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese. Both groups did not want to have anything occurring along those borders, mm-hmm. and they both had mutuality of interest. In many instances, the South Vietnamese, as the war lingered on, after 68, after the Tet incursion, mm-hmm. a lot of the individuals in the South had come to the conclusion that there was going to be a probably a North Vietnamese victory because the Americans weren't going to stay. The Americans have never been known as long-term occupiers. So, you know, that wasn't in the cards. I think that for the most part, the South Vietnamese, in many instances, were quite disgruntled with the Americans in their particular actions. And depending upon where those South Vietnamese came from, when we did a lot of bombing, and in many instances indiscriminate bombing, which killed members of families that were within the establishment itself, the South Vietnamese establishment. This creates not too good. Likewise, we gave to various groups like Key and his cohorts, we would put them into positions of power. And when you take one group out and put another one into power, of course you have a lot of disgruntled individuals. So yes, that occurs. Again, I don't think unlike what's happening today in Iraq. It's the Sunni. I mean, our mistake is now, after all this time, putting the Sunni back in, because now you made the Shia mad.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a never-ending... Now, I mean, if we're looking at it in the Middle East, we may be looking at it from a totally different perspective. We may be looking for being just chaotic and want to continue to create a chaotic situation there in Iraq. I don't know. If that's our end goal, we sure have done a good job of it.
And then, I know that your experience in the spring offensive was kind of
where the boys were sent up to play coup. Yeah, a bunch of individuals from Ben Din went up for the spring offensive, went in to play coup when the North Vietnamese came down in to play coup. Mm-hmm. Again, this was psychologically more a situation than in reality, because what it was the need to build up the American population, that the spring offensive was occurring and everything, but at the same time the North Vietnamese had an objective in it. Mm-hmm. So both sides, it's like Saddam and weapons of mass destruction, both sides would say the same thing. Mm-hmm. But in reality, the amounts of troops and material and everything were probably 50% of what was, you know, in reality told. And that was another thing in Vietnam. It's not, I don't know why it occurs, but it does a lot, is the indiscriminate use of numbers by observers to make an image which is quite different than what occurs. In other words, a group might go out and you may find two or three or four people firing. And I don't know what it is, but we react with a brigade. That is one of the most inefficient aspects of warfare. When you start doing that, you, by the nature of doing it, you're beginning to lose the war. Because what you're doing is you're using manpower, you're overextending your abilities to destroy something which is not anywhere near what the necessity is. So every time you do this, you compound loss of monies, loss of everything. Mm-hmm. So this, in especially an army that's in an unknown environment, they do that. Mm-hmm. And what we would do is we'd bring in, let's say, four gunships. It'd be one guy. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if you did that every time, you could figure out the cost of that. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, it was way beyond anything that should be done like that. And it was prevalent. And I don't know if it's because a lot of the individuals were brought up in the cities, mm-hmm. and just didn't understand the countrysides or the fact of how to really deal with an enemy. What they believed in was that firepower could override all of that, which firepower does, but at a cost. Mm. It's immense. So that's not a good. It's better to get a truly specialized group together, be able to. It's like the Al Qaeda. You know, what are we doing? Trying to expend all of the amounts of money and people and everything. Most of the people who are sending those airports don't even know can't even spell Al Qaeda. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, why not create, first of all, find out, get your information and derive your information from whoever the necessity is of finding out what the organization is, mm-hmm. then get specialists who go after it. Mm-hmm. But don't try to create a whole new organization, mm-hmm. to fight against something which you don't know what it is in the first place. Mm-hmm. It's a word, Al-Qaeda, the foundation, that's what it means. Mm-hmm. Well, what is the foundation? Who's in the foundation? Mm-hmm. What is the foundation? How is it? I don't know. Have you ever seen an organizational chart of Al-Qaeda?
No.
No. I don't think anybody has. I bet you if you ask an intelligence officer, he hasn't found one either.
I mean, because... It
doesn't exist. What the hell are we doing?
Yeah.
You know, that's what I'm saying. Then let's go do something which does exist and fight against it. But don't go and just say it. You know, it doesn't exist, and so therefore we'll continue to put monies and everything into it. If it doesn't exist, then let's go after what does exist, and let's be practical about it. I don't mind being practical. I mean, even if we're doing the wrong thing. As long as you're efficient and practical, do it. But don't come up with crazy illusions.
Yeah,
that's not gonna help at all.
Would you say Phoenix could be the same way, like a system that was built?
No, Phoenix was systematic in the fact that Phoenix was built for the purpose of destruction of the enemy political infrastructure. It had a mission. It derived its, probably if you want to say, derived its information from the various internal security groups in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Whether or not this was always correct, I can say it wasn't. But there was some basis.
Do you guys want something to drink or something?
Yeah, I'll have something to drink. Some.
What would you like?
Have some water.
Water?
Or lemonade?
I'll make some lemonade.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, Phoenix, and Phoenix occurs again and again, because Phoenix is, you know, I'm sure that there's a Phoenix group right now somewhere, you know, doing the same thing. Phoenix, by its nature, is going to try to eliminate the enemies, mm-hmm. perceived enemies, mm-hmm. of the U.S. Now, Al-Qaeda, on the other hand, does not have a country of origin, does not have a specific mission. Mm-hmm. Various Al-Qaeda operatives, or whatever you want to call them, say different things. I want to blow up this, or I want to blow up, but they don't say, there's no really Al-Qaeda individual who really said, I want to kill every American person. Mm. That's never occurred. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you don't have a specific, you do in Phoenix. Because mm-hmm. Phoenix, you can put in Pakistan, Phoenix, you can put in Afghanistan, Phoenix, you can put in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And you can create the organization. All you have to do is go to the records, recreate it.
Yeah.
You can bring in new young people. Hopefully, if they do create it, they will look at the old and say, this is what we don't want. We shuffle this off. We want to consolidate this side. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, in Phoenix, possibly, you know, Phoenix should have been more towards psychological warfare in some ways. Phoenix should have been more towards a method of cultural knowledge for the young officers, and what their real mission was, and what the mission of their advisees were. In other words, if you're an advisor, you're a Phoenix advisor or coordinator, you should know that the Vietnamese were not just there to kill, just like in Pakistan. They weren't just there to kill Al-Qaeda, but they were there to kill the Pashtu or the Baluchi or somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, those are things that we should have been teaching our young officers, but we weren't. We said, everybody was up after the BCI, and that was it, the Viet Cong. That's probably absolutely incorrect. So, I'm an advocate of some type of structure like the Phoenix.
Would you like M&A too, or do you want water?
Whatever, it's fine.
Okay.
I believe that if done properly and done professionally, Phoenix could be, like I say, it could be something which can be utilized quite well and has the potential of at least being able to give some type of formula to a situation. I'm not sure, you know, groups like Blackwater or that are the best methods of doing that. And if there was a Phoenix advisor, he should be in charge of every living soul that's outside the military. In a province or in an area. And if you have a bunch of contractors who are doing that, mm-hmm. He should be directly responsible for everything about them, and bring them to justice if they do what they shouldn't be doing. Mm-hmm. That's another thing that probably with Phoenix we should do, is have a regulatory, an inspector general, mm-hmm. or so that there was a more reality to it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What time is it for you?
Oh.
3:30? See, I'm yapping, 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 Poo-poo.
Huh?
I said I'm yapping, yapping, yapping.
You have a headache?
No. I've got a pimple. I do have a...
What?
I'll stop that, though.
Oh, I do really.
Yeah. I hope I don't get it. Johnny stuff. Okay.
One thing I was wondering, and if this is not something you want to talk about, that's mm-hmm. totally okay. But and you talked about to Doug about the the aftermath of the spring offensive, and you said that you saw a lot of civilians be disappeared, and that kind of changed the way you viewed viewed the program. I was wondering if...
Well, no, I mean, again, the fact was that in Benden, one has to recognize the history of Benden. Mm-hmm. Benden was always a North Vietnamese stronghold. Mm-hmm. So therefore, the fact was that there were tremendous amounts of North Vietnamese sympathizers mm-hmm. in Benden. Depending upon the province chief and the district chiefs, you would have one district chief or one province chief who would be very much aware of what was needed to keep his district or province in a kind of copacetic situation. Mm-hmm. With Ben Dinh, there was never copacetic, because any time any new province, and most of the province province chiefs came from to the south, mm-hmm. and the Ben Dinh didn't like them. Mm-hmm. So there was always constant warfare. And warfare was like clans. So you had that situation. With the offensive that occurred, they were trying again, I would presume, not like the Nazis or something in the Ukraine. You know, they were trying a last ditch stand and trying to round up as many as they could. And the reasoning behind all of this is usually in the numbers, if you really get down to it. It's, and I don't know this because I wasn't at that level, but was it the Americans who were saying, your numbers are too low, mm-hmm. and so therefore we want you to raise your numbers, so the people who were more or less in charge of these various organizations would go out and swoop up these groups and take them out. Yeah, they would do things that were not too good, because the South Vietnamese, as I say, especially the ones from deeper in the South, had an aversion for Ben Dinh, and literally it was like almost a warfare of clans. Mm-hmm. So if they picked up a bunch of people in Ben Dinh, you could literally see in instances where they would take a plane and an armored plane and fly it out over the Tonkin Gulf and come back with no one in it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that occurred. Mm-hmm. Again, was that a particular person or was that an official thing? I don't think so. I think it was like the wars that occurred, like I say, in Kansas and Missouri. Mm-hmm. It was just a deep feelings that the North Vietnamese were the enemy, the South Vietnamese were the enemy, and they would fight each other over this type of territory. So
it's kind of like collective punishment then?
There would be collective punishment, because the fact was that the Arvind and the GVN government always considered Ben Dinh a thorn in their side. Mm. Because, see, a lot of the North Vietnamese came into Ben Dinh at one point in time and had children who were, and the children considered themselves to be North Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. So, for whatever reason, and it's a historical reason, this war occurred. Again, it could also have been, though, because a new province chief came into Ben Dinh mm-hmm. and said, let's get rid of these characters once and for all. They're a thorn in our side. Mm-hmm. Where the other guys had always kind of said, hey, you know, when I first got there, I know that we wouldn't go out on too many picking up of people and everything. Mm-hmm. Because, as I say, when I first got there, they kind of said to me, you know, we've been doing this several years, and it doesn't help any. We let them go, we take them out, we let them go, let them go. The last, you know, like I say, that one offensive, they didn't take out more than normal. They put a lot more into the prisons. Mm-hmm. So where they went, I don't know. I do know that at least one instance, we did see that a group went away and didn't come back. So, yeah. And I don't know if they could have flown them out and then flown them down to the down the coast and put them off somewhere else. I'm not going to say what happened to them. Mm-hmm. But I know that the plane came back and went anybody. So.
Yeah. Now, Doug has you quoted as saying that there's 30,000 people disappeared.
Oh, I'd say that's probably true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a close number. Yeah, 30,000 people had been done, disappeared at one point in time. Over the period, it wasn't like a day, it was over maybe a 6-month period or something like that. Mm-hmm. Probably. Yeah. It's a lot of people who, and again, it was because of the fact of cleaning out the areas up in the north of Ben Din. Mm-hmm. Wayan, Phuket, Phu My, all of those different districts were like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't remember what it was. I think you can get some statistics from one of the war colleges or something that says what the number of casualties and
in that time period.
Yeah, you can kind of bring in with the, and then you can figure that out to some degree.
Yeah,
because you know, there wasn't that much at the end there in 72 or so. There wasn't that many battles occurring, really. Mm-hmm. Like I say, the one that was occurring up at Phuket, well, not Phuket, but up in the mountains, Pleiku, mm-hmm. it was not that dramatically large, but you know, but yeah, there were a lot of people who passed away in that area. Well, they also, I mean, not only did they disappear from that, but they B-52 bombings, mm-hmm. tremendous amount in the offensive. Mm-hmm. They just blew the hell out of everything all the way in, 10 miles in. I mean, the only other time I've ever seen as much disaster was in at Bay St. Louis when the damn hurricane directly hit it. Uh-huh. You know, it was. But it was like that. I mean, the whole village was
just flat.
Yeah. It was that whole offensive that went forward up into that north. Mm-hmm. Then fell back. And I was up in, what was that, Benoit. I was in Benoit district. And the north came when they had the offensive. The north came from the north, mm-hmm. and man, they just blew the hell out of the Arvin, because mm-hmm. the Arvin just wasn't regimented. I mean, they went through the Arvin like a sieve, mm-hmm. and would kill with hand pistols, would shoot the Arvin as they ran away. Mm-hmm. The Arvin was. Like I said, they hadn't been paid. They were just disillusioned.
So, it was terrible.
So that occurred. Well, let me go to the loop for a second.
Okay.